Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, as I am each and every month, I'm joined by Dr. Craig Joseph, the ever acerbic pediatrician and chief medical officer of Nordic Consulting Partners. Craig, thanks for joining me.
Hello. And, I wasn't going to go with acerbic. I wasn't sure you were going to go with acerbic. I'm not sure what I've done to you lately, but I apologize.
It's that rapier wit that I love.
Again, you're throwing all these adjectives at me, and it's concerning to me, and I need a dictionary now. And
Look, there is just no way that I don't believe you watched Monty Python as a kid, so don't give me any of that.
Listen, I'm from the United States, so I don't really speak English. I'm going to do my best in understanding you, but that's all you can ask of me. So.
Hello. So kicking off, so last month we talked a little bit about testing. There was some changes, shall we say, in the CDC's position. They had sort of said, no, we better not test. I think that's now changed. A little bit of an update on that. We're now back to testing. Any thoughts where we are with testing and what we should be doing?
Well, it goes to show you how smart we are. When last we spoke, the CDC had just put out, without much fanfare, a significant change to their testing recommendations, which had said in the past, hey, if you were exposed to someone who was positive for COVID-19, you should get a test even if you have no symptoms, with the hope that the vast majority of people who got those tests would come back negative. But some folks would come back positive, often before they showed symptoms, which is when they would be most contagious. And so to prevent those folks from kind of getting out and about, it was worth it. And all of a sudden that had changed. And you and I were pondering why that might be. Because of course, if you've got a disease like COVID-19 that's out in the community, and if you know that for 2 or 3 days, typically at the beginning of that disease, you have no symptoms whatsoever, you feel great, yet you're incredibly contagious. And so you and I had been saying, why wouldn't we want the most testing? Why wouldn't we offer free testing to people walking into the grocery store randomly to try to get a sense of what's going on in the community? And as it turns out, the CDC did go back ultimately into their previous recommendation, and which is where we're at today. And now I think even more what we had been talking about is coming true, as I see that, or I learned that at certain airports, I think in somewhere in California, maybe San Francisco, that they are offering, or LA, somewhere they're offering tests for folks. Tampa, that's not in California, that's in Florida. But there are various places where they're offering either free or reduced costs, immediate testing for the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And I think that's a great thing. And, if we could, we should test every single person every single day. That's how we would get rid of this. Now, we can't do that. We're not going to do that. But that's the fastest way to squelching this, would everyone to get a test every day. And we'd find it. And then people who were positive but were not symptomatic yet would be home, not infecting all of their friends and family.
And to be clear around that, you sort of talk about we won't test everybody all of the time, but I'm not going to step over the boundary of forcing people, because I understand individual freedoms and so forth. But the reality of this, if you can simplify the testing, and we've seen some great progress on this, so just the Abbott BNAX system, it's a cartridge based and relatively low cost, certainly compared to the PCR molecular tests that we've seen, down to around, I think the numbers I've seen, around 15, and I'm sure at volume will come down. But the important thing is that it's an instant test, relatively easy to effectively deliver. And a couple of things that need to happen for this to work out is, one, it can't require a medical professional of any description to have to give the test. So for the most part, it needs to be saliva based, I think, because people have a little bit of a struggle. Although I've seen some of these nasopharyngeal, certainly the shorter versions that people use. And then the other thing is it can't require a laboratory. So the analogy I use all the time is it's got to be the pregnancy strip of this. And I think we're going to see that, and we're going to see it at a low cost. Let's call it a dollar. I don't think that's an impossible pathway. And that will then be available, to your point, daily. Walk into the store. Hey, we're going to test you. We'll get an instant result. And I understand the challenges around requiring people and, you know, the limitations. If you don't take the test, can you come in and so forth? Put that to one side and just talk about it from a pure epidemiology and prevention standpoint. And, you know, I'm going to raise my hand and say, I want things to get back to some level of normality. I can tell you this mask, face covering thing is... it's frustrating, especially if you have to do it for an extended period of time. You know, when you're out, I can't tell you, I'm still forgetting to take it. Here we are months in and I forget to take it if I'm going out. So that's our pathway to doing it. And I think we've got the potential to do it, but we have to do it in billions of tests and on a frequency that is ongoing. So I think there's good potential. Yale has produced this saliva direct test. Still requires some laboratory, but again, you know, quicker, more instant read and, you know, standardized equipment, you know, and less consumables. That's the other thing. We've got challenges with these nasopharyngeal swabs. You know, you come up with all these problems that you wouldn't have essentially thought about. Great. So you've got to stick a swab up somebody's nose, but we've got to have all those swabs. And then, by the way, just like the face coverings are now the cigarette butts of trash that I see in every parking lot that I go to, we're producing all of this trash. Anything that can prevent or reduce that, I think, is going to be good. So I'm hopeful, but hopeful that we can test people more frequently.
Yeah, I would say I agree with everything that you said. Although we know that masking is, while annoying, is the easiest and most low cost and, you know, unobtrusive thing you could possibly do to significantly get us back to some sense of normalcy. But it's difficult, and some people won't do it because they just think that it's not a thing. Yeah, this would be another way, but obviously sticking a Q-tip up your nose every day or multiple times a day will get very annoying very quickly. And I think the other thing is that, you know, we need society to support the fact that people who test positive or who have symptoms should be home. And so if you're going to be threatening folks with losing money or losing their job because they're not feeling well, then we know what's going to happen. You're going to go to work, and you're going to go on that bus, and you're going to go on that plane, and you're going to avoid the free test because you have a suspicion that you might have it. It's human nature. I totally get it. And so without the kind of support from the government and from one another to say that, hey, you know, it's actually in our best interest for you not to come to work if you're not feeling well. And if that means that...
I think you bring up such an important point. We haven't talked about this. And, you know, I came from a different country where sick leave and sick time was treated entirely differently. And I have to tell you, my shock to the system was the way in which you had a sick bank. It was part of your vacation time. And, you know, this essentially hugely negative perception. And I know people that would be dying of flu, colds, whatever, and they were coming into work because they did not want to lose their precious, by the way, very precious in this country because they give so little of it, vacation time. Again, another shock to the system. You start work, and for the first year, you've got no vacation time. Oh, and by the way, no sick time. Got to fix that as well, I think.
Well, so first of all, again, agree with you, but you know, you're coming at it from kind of a human rights standpoint and what's good for the individual person, and that's well and good, and I happen to agree with that. My argument today would not even have anything to do with that. It would simply say, actually, you sick person, it helps me, so I'm not even worried about you. You know, like, you're actually worried about people, and I find that, you know, quaint and nice. I'm thinking about me, right? Number one. And it is safer for me to have you not at work. That's how I get to be able to go on airplanes and eat at restaurants and go to parties and have people over to my house. I can do all of those things if sick people don't go out. And if we can identify well-feeling people before they get sick. And so, you know, I wouldn't even try and make the argument, which is very valid and very good, that you're making. And I would simply say, hey, it's in everyone's best interest if we want to get back to normal to do these things. And even just looking out for number one kind of works. There's the cynical viewpoint. That might be one of the things you called me during the introduction. I'm not sure because again, those are big words with lots of vowels, but there it is.
Okay,
I put it out
challenge
there,
accepted. I'm going to find some other terms for you for the next year, that's for sure. So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist, and today I'm talking to Dr. Craig Joseph. He is the pediatrician and also the chief medical officer for Nordic Consulting Partners. We were just talking about testing, update on testing and sick time, and you were just talking about sort of, you know, benefit to others and, you know, the value of sick time. And that leads me to another area that I know you've been looking at and, you know, obviously as a pediatrician comes with some significant challenges in the context of what's happened over the last several months, and that's vaccinations and kids. And I think what you saw was a decline, right?
Well, we've been assuming that this was happening, right? Because doctor's offices starting in mid-March were closed, and often just closed, as in no options. If you're really, really sick, go to the emergency room. Otherwise, good luck, God bless, stay at home. And this is before telemedicine would really started taking off. And so now there are options, and most offices are now open, at least in part, if not fully. However, young children under two get a lot of vaccines for very good reasons, right? And so these are diseases that kill and injure small children, and they're fully preventable. And now these are the same children that have not been able to go to the doctor's office. Again, completely understand you have a well 6 month old at home. Where's the last place you want to take them to is a doctor's office where there might be sick people. Now, as an aside, this particular virus, COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2, does not seem to be affecting affect children in the way that it affects adults. Seems to be they can get it and they can give it to you, but they don't seem to have at the high risk. Of course, we know that there are children that have died of COVID-19, but a small number compared to elderly and adults with chronic medical conditions. That said, what now we have data to support is that kids aren't getting their vaccines. And there's a cohort of children, again, we're really focusing on under 18 months, who are behind with all of their vaccines, not because their parents are afraid of the vaccines, but because their parents haven't taken them to the doctor's office. And so we really got to get these children caught up. Otherwise, we are going to run into seeing some of these diseases of childhood that most pediatricians probably have never seen. So there's meningitis, Haemophilus influenza type B, Hib. Hib meningitis was before my time even the most common cause of hearing loss and brain problems from meningitis in young children. I remember one of my attendings telling me that he would admit at least two or three kids with Hib meningitis. I've never seen in my career Hib meningitis because of this vaccine, and this is the vaccine that is not. This is one of them that's not being given. And so I don't know what the solution is other than a big kind of public awareness that you're missing more when you go to those checkups. The vaccines are super important. And there will be, unfortunately, consequences of not keeping up with that. And now, you know, we have the evidence, at least from a billing standpoint, ironically, from the government. That's where this information came from. They get billed. And so they know that they're not getting billed nearly as much for Medicaid and other populations that that get free vaccines. And so, yeah, it's a problem, and it's the same concern that we've had for adults who have chronic medical problems, who are not getting, you know, for patients with diabetes who are not getting their eye checks and their feet checks and other things like that. We know what happens for patients who aren't getting their cancer screening. We know what's going to happen. It just hasn't happened yet. And so we're seeing it with kids. Thankfully, I'm not aware of any epidemics of vaccine-preventable diseases yet, but it's certainly something that we have to watch out for. So certainly would encourage any parents out there to make sure to get your kids as up-to-date as possible, as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and I, you know, thank you for reminding me, because I can clearly recall the sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach anytime I was called to the emergency room for a young child, baby with, you know, high fever. And it was the big concern around that was meningitis. And, you know, here we are, we've managed to purge it, and we're essentially opening the door to having that disease reoccur. And we've got a whole host of other problems of, you know, this anti-vaccine crowd that, you know, are essentially driven by essentially a non-physician. He was struck off the register for his misbehavior. Wakefield shows up in the United States and continues to peddle his nonsense. And it's just a tragedy. I guess my question is, you know, as you think about your practice and, you know, when you were practicing, things have opened up. So is there some opportunity to catch up? Should we be going out into the community? What can we do to try and address that cohort? Or are we now going to watch this group now move through society or time rather and emerge with more challenges?
They can be caught up. That's not a question. So it's you can always be, no matter how delayed you are with your childhood vaccines, you can always be caught up. And in fact, oftentimes you can be caught up at a much faster schedule. So, you know, for instance, we might do the same series of vaccines at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, and then 12 to 15 months for one of them. That gives you, you know, 2 months between vaccines. Oftentimes you really only need 30 days. And so we space them out a little bit more than we need to, but we know we can safely and effectively give them more frequently or a smaller interval of time. So those kids can absolutely get caught up. All they need to do is go to their family doctor or their pediatrician to do that. And so in order for parents to feel comfortable doing that, they have to, you know, feel comfortable that it's safe for them to do that. There has been talk of, there are vaccine clinics where you can go to the public health department. There are some places where, that we're talking about, I think the federal government's actually talking about allowing pharmacists to give childhood vaccines. I'm a little concerned about that. That's a whole nother story. But to your point, this is absolutely not a lost generation or cohort. Those kids can absolutely be caught up. We just need to do it as soon as possible, however they do it. You know, oftentimes we do these vaccine fairs, which you can't really do very much now, right? I mean, so this is not a problem that no one's ever had. We've had these problems before where there have been certain areas where vaccines, where kids have fallen behind for one reason or another. But a lot of the public health outreaches that we have done, we can't do now. We can't, you know, take an auditorium and fill it with nurses giving vaccines. So it really has to be done in kind of an individual, small office. And so we need parents to feel comfortable going to the doctor. That's what it really is. Kind of getting right back. We're going in a circle. Masks, right? Testing. And whenever, hopefully it comes, safe and effective vaccines. And when we get those, or two out of three of those, then people will feel comfortable and we'll be back to where we were.
And I think, you know, the important point here is that it is safe to return and go and visit. I think, you know, all my experiences and everything I've seen, you know, in large part, you're dealing with a community, physician offices, you know, healthcare professionals who know and understand how to manage and control disease. They're trained in aseptic technique, in the use of, you know, proper protective equipment, and have designed their interactions to allow for that safe return to the office. So I think it's important to take from this, at least I do, that you can catch up and should catch up, and you should get on and do that as quickly as possible so that we, you know, get rid of that challenge that's going to emerge. And the same with flu, which I think we've talked about. This is definitely the season. You know, go out, get your flu vaccine. Our family has. We're all vaccinated and, you know, glad to be so. In thinking about the safety, one of the things that's sort of floating around, if you like how I use that word, when we talk about aerosols and droplets in the ether of, you know, discussion, is the challenge around how this disease is spread. Any thoughts, anything that you've seen that it's relevant to that currently?
Well, it's the ongoing question. We certainly know it's a respiratory. Every week, it seems there's stronger evidence that contact, meaning it's difficult to get this disease by touching a doorknob. Not impossible, but every week it seems that the evidence is stronger that it's more and more difficult. So really, you're getting this from breathing in something. And so the question is, how big are those particles, right? And typically, this would be a conversation that you and I would never get into because we are not really into the kinetics and physics of small globules of water. I just made up that term. That's not the right term. But now it is important, right? Because when you breathe out or you cough or you laugh, if these are very, very small particles, then they float in the air as opposed to slightly bigger particles that fall to the ground. Right. So when we say that you need to be 6 feet away, you ideally want to be at least 6 feet away from others and masked. We're assuming that these are the larger particles and that if you breathe, cough, laugh, sing loudly, all of those things, those particles are generally bigger, heavier, and fall to the ground. If they're tiny aerosols, very, very small, they can float for hours. And then the danger becomes, well, is 6 feet enough? It's clearly not, if that's the case. And another thing that can contribute to aerosols being a problem is poor ventilation. And so if you kind of have stale air, if you don't have air conditioning or heat moving air through, it's more likely that those aerosols will kind of just be floating out there waiting for you to walk into the room from someone that might have been there an hour before. Again, we still know that this is not very easily transmissible like some diseases. You know, this is not as dangerous and easily infectable as others, but
this is no measles, that's for sure. Thank God.
I don't think a lot of people know what you're talking about, but measles is a great example. And so with measles, the attack rate, you know, is I think it's 16, 20 times more than
I think you could get measles across a Zoom call. It's so damn infected.
It's so easy to get measles. Now,
our naught number is about 18, I believe.
Now, how many kids have I seen with measles? Maybe once I think I saw a kid with measles. Yeah. Why is that? Is it because all you have to do is wash your hands? No, it's because we have a measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. I just wanted to throw that in there, right? So I've rarely seen measles, maybe once or twice in my life because of the vaccine. That said, if you have a patient with measles, it is super easy for them. And you should assume that almost everyone that came, and even in hardly a contact with them, has gotten it. If COVID-19 were as contagious as measles, we'd be in trouble, right? We'd be in big, big trouble. So yeah, so that's the controversy. That's what science is still trying to figure out. Are these droplets big? Are they small? What can you do about it? Nothing besides what we're doing, which is trying to stay away from other folks, keep your masks on. Key, though, is if you're going to be inside, good ventilation is really going to be essential.
Right. And I think to sort of close on that, the key things, so face coverings remain important. There is no question about it. We've known this since 1918 and the pandemic then. We've talked about that. Indoors, more challenging because of the enclosed space. You talk about ventilation, the important aspect of that is external air, which is one of the challenges we've had with buildings where they said, let's hermetically seal these things. It can be more efficient from an economic standpoint, heating, cooling, and so forth. And I think we're rethinking it. We can filter out with some of the filtration, and even standalone filtration units in enclosed spaces can be beneficial in this particular instance. But reducing that exposure, I think, is critical. Unfortunately, as usual, we've run out of time, but always a pleasure. And my challenge has been accepted. We'll be looking for some alternative terms for my good friend, Dr. Craig Joseph. Craig, thanks for joining me again this month.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, TheIncrementalist, or share with me at Dr. Nick One on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.